From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is running a two-week retrospective of the films of director Milos Forman. Not just One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus, but also the early work he made in his native Czechoslovakia. On today's Fresh Air, Forman will tell us about making films in America and his formative days in Czechoslovakia. He says growing up under the Gestapo was a tragedy and life under the communists was absurd. Also, film critic David Edelstein asks if the new thriller Jumper, about a guy with the power to transport himself anywhere, actually does go anywhere. And I look at the CBS premiere of Dexter, the very edgy Showtime series about a police forensic expert with a very deadly hobby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is Academy Award-winning director Milos Forman. His American films include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, Amadeus, and The People vs. Larry Flint. A two-week retrospective of his work began last night at New York's Museum of Modern Art. Forman began his film career working under the communist bureaucracy in his native country of Czechoslovakia. His Czech movie Fireman's Ball played at the New York Film Festival in 1967 and was his ticket to the U.S. Terry first interviewed Forman in 1994 about his memoir called Turnaround. Milos Forman was a child during World War II when the Gestapo was in charge. After the war in 1948, the communists took over. Both of Forman's parents died in Nazi death camps. His father was on the fringes of the underground. One of the Nazis responsible for the death of Forman's parents had been one of their employees years before.
My parents built a very small 15-room pension, or little hotel, if you want, in former Sudetenland, which was the part of Czechoslovakia which was taken over by the Nazis first, by the Germans first. And as a kind of a foreman on the building of this pension in 1920-something, I was not even born, was a German citizen there who, and I know that my parents were very fair people and they treated him fairly, but when the Nazi came to power, suddenly this man, of course, was somehow humiliated that he worked for some Czechs, which is, you know, not a race or nation which is, you know, up to the Nazi or German stature. And by sheer coincidence, this man ended up in the Gestapo in Kolín, which was the town under which Czaslav, a little town in the middle of Bohemia, was under. And when he got all these names, and he saw the names of my parents, first my father and then my mother, he just stamped the paper with a stamp which said the return undesirable. And that's it. And then they perished.
Your mother was taken by the Gestapo after they came to search your house. What was it like? You were, I think, 7 years old or something?
I was 8 and a half. Yeah, I was 8 and a half years old. I was sick that day, and I was, I had a fever, I had a flu, I was in bed, and I heard, you know, that some voices downstairs, because we were living in a little house, you know, one-story house in Czaslav, and for a long time, and I knew that something is strange, because I heard that strange noises from downstairs. And then I hear steps coming upstairs, and then the door open a crack, and my mother is there, and she's handing me a cup of water and a pill, and says, now they take the pill. And I said, but I shouldn't be taking the pill until the afternoon. The Gestapo is here. And she just gave me that. So I took the pill, and I, the door closed, and I saw a man standing behind her there. And then I realized why she's telling me that, because I was my bedroom was a tiny little room behind which was another tiny little room to which the door were covered by a cupboard. And to keep the fresh air in, the cupboard was always a little bit away from the door. And I realized that she wants me to push the cupboard back to the wall so that it covers the door. And when they come to my bedroom for search, that they will not find it. But I was too weak, and the cupboard was oak wood and very, very heavy. I took all the things out, and I was trying to push it back, and I didn't succeed. That was the most horrible feeling, because I felt like I failed my family. The irony is that then when they came in and found out, you know, this other room there, they went in, they looked around, they went out, they were even smiling at me. And then they went down again with my mother. But then I hear the door click, and then there was silence. And this was, you know, they came like 8 o'clock in the morning, and this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was silence. And I hear the car going away from in the street, and there is a total silence. They just didn't even let my mother go upstairs and say goodbye. And I am alone, absolutely alone in the whole house. And there was nobody in the town of Czaslav, you know, who would come home.
So that's the last time you ever saw your mother?
No, then we had a very, you know, sort of, it's everything is such paradox, you know. About a year later, suddenly we were allowed a visit with our mother. Me, my brother, and my uncle, you know, my mother's brother. So we went to Prague. We were taken down to the catacombs of a former bank, which was now at Gestapo headquarters in Prague. And we are, they, you know, locked us in, closed the door, and we are sitting there, my brother, my uncle, for about over 2 hours. And then the door opens, and in the door, they brought in my mother. And from the, in the first moment, I realized she didn't know why where they are taking her. They obviously didn't tell her that she's not going to be interrogated or whatever, that she's going to meet her family. And we had 10 minutes allowed with her. And the funny paradox is that, you know, what do you... Now when I recall it, all we were talking about, mother was asking, oh, how were the prunes this year? And did you have enough sugar to make a jam? And how is Mrs. Procházková? It was absolute, and she was just holding me all these 10 minutes, you know. And then the man said, you know, goodbye, and say goodbye. So the mother left, never saw her again.
So what was it like for you to go through the rest of the war without parents?
Well, that's another big paradox. You know, a child doesn't really perceive the tragedy like that. Especially, you know, I probably would be much more stricken by grief if my parents died yesterday than when they died when I was a child. And because child doesn't really perceive the finality of life. The death is, especially in these cases, because they were away. They were somewhere.
Right, you didn't know they were going
to
die.
So you don't know they are going to die. They are somewhere. And then one day, somebody tells you, in this case it was my uncle, told me, listen, my sister, your mother died. But in my daily life, nothing changed. You know,
so you had family, extended family to bring you up, uncles?
Oh, my relatives were taking care of me, yes.
I want you to recall a specific day during the war, and this is a day that must have had special significance for you. It's the day that the Germans decreed that all the art houses had to close, the theater, the ballet, the orchestra, the movies. Were you already interested in the arts when that happened?
I was very much. Well, not interested. I was seduced because I was a child again. You know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old. And my brother, who is 12 years older than I am, he was like 23 years old. He was a set designer for a traveling small group, theater group company, which was playing operettas. And every time when they came to town where I was living with my relatives, you know, I was every day, I was backstage. And, you know, I was just mesmerized by the atmosphere of the theater. And, because I was a little kid, you know, nobody kicked me out from the ladies' dressing room, right? So that was very, very exciting. And then, you know, I didn't know anything, you know, why it's happening. It was the most weird experience because I remember very well. Polish Blood is the name of the operetta. It's a very fluffy, light operetta. And this was 1944. And suddenly in the third act, during a very merry kind of a song, it was like a quartet or a quintet, and the ballet dancers and things on the stage, suddenly the singers stopped singing and started to cry, tears running down. And the orchestra stopped, conductor stopped. The people in the theater were sitting silently, quietly. Nobody was sort of upset or surprised. I just didn't know what's happening. Then the conductor tried to start the aria or the quintet again. They started to try to sing again this very merry, happy song. And again, in the middle of the song, they broke down and in tears and cried. And then the man came on the stage and said, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you understand the emotional state of the artist who will not be able to finish the performance today. Thank you for coming. It was so nice. Good night. And the curtain went down, and that was the end of culture. Because I didn't know that the day before, the Germans just canceled culture. The next day, every single singer, every single dancer, every single musician had to go and enlist himself or herself in a factories to work for the victory of the Third Reich.
Film director Miloš Forman speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1994 interview with film director Miloš Forman. A 2-week retrospective of his work opened last night at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. When we left off, Forman was talking about life in Czechoslovakia under the Nazis. Let's skip ahead to a few years after World War II, when the communists had taken over the country.
You ended up trying to go to theater school. You were rejected from theater school and ended up in film school, which I suppose was really lucky.
Well, for me, definitely.
Lucky break, yeah. Had you seen a lot of movies growing up?
Oh, yeah, in the film school. It was another paradox of communist society, because it was the best school I could ever be going into, because after the communists took over, they purged from public life the best writers, the best filmmakers, the best artists in the country, because they were not enough in creating in the vein of socialist realism for them. So they purged them, but they couldn't kill them. They had to give them some chance to make a living, so make a meager living in teaching. So the result was that at the film school we had the best minds, the greatest artists, which were teaching us, which we could talk to.
Milan Kundera
was one of them.
Yeah, wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being was one of your teachers.
Yes, Book of Laughter and Forgetting, The Joke, wonderful books.
One of the things that you did, I think this was while you were in film school or just afterwards, you hosted what you describe as a sort of Czech socialist realist Thursday night at the movies show on TV. So what was the show like? What made it the social realist version?
First of all, the paranoia and of the communists to control every word which goes to the public. And television was only live. In that time, there was not Ampex and tapes at all. So it had to be live. They had to control everything. So you had to write everything down, learn it by heart, word by word. The censor was sitting somewhere watching you, checking if you are saying exactly the words which you had to send the text to the office, to the Bureau of Censors. They had to put a stamp on it, send it back to you, eventually make some corrections, Then you had to learn it by heart, and then they were checking if you are saying it exactly, which was sometimes absolutely ridiculous, because you are sort of, I was doing it like a improvised, like a live dialogue, conversation with somebody.
So what would you say to introduce a film? Do you remember any of the introductions you did?
All the introductions had to, I was always trying to show on the television films which had some, which were not just the propaganda films, but then, of course, you had to present them in the way which the communists would accept. If it was film from France, for example, Children of Paradise, beautiful, romantic film, but you had to stress that this film is showing the cruelty of bourgeoisie, how it's suppressing the working class people,
Did you believe any of that?
Of course not. Because everybody knew it's nonsense. Right. It's a game. It's right. A game,
When you started writing and directing movies, did you have to avoid what government officials would have defined as bourgeois subject matter?
I was lucky because for some reasons they think, my first films were comedies, basically, in films in Czechoslovakia. And they perceive comedies as something not as important, something light, make it, it's just funny, it's just like that. So I was able to do these films very much the way I wanted to do them.
What kind of taste in movies did the cultural apparatchiks have?
Oh, that's how it's wonderful to work hard and to surpass the outcome of steel from his steel mill, 10% more than the steel mills in capitalist bourgeois decadent society. That was the greatest art. Now the basic, you know, the basic dilemma or paradox or discrepancy in the art philosophy is that what we are doing here, we are telling stories about life as it is, while the communist propaganda wants to tell and describe in the books or on the screen the life as it should be according to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so boring, you can't imagine.
One of the best known of your Czechoslovakian films was Fireman's Ball. And this was a comedy. And in the version that's in circulation now, I don't know when you put this part in. I mean, I know you put it in the late 60s. The film opens with you in front of the camera explaining that, first of all, Fireman's Ball was released just before the Dubček leadership took over, and that the film had a very surprising reaction. 40,000 firemen resigned in protest against this film.
Well, they were ordered to resign. This film was banned. This film was banned right away when it was finished, and officially written for eternity.
No, why was it banned? You said comedies weren't considered as dangerous. Is this a comedy?
Well, they thought it's a metaphor on the Politburo and the Communist Party, you know, that Fireman's Ball Committee, right? That it's a metaphor for the whole leadership of the country, so they banned the film. No, for the, you know, that was orchestrated by the government people, this strike or the threat of practically all the volunteer firemen in the whole country to because they needed, you know, the people were so apathetic already, you know, they didn't give a damn. But of course, if the people read in the newspapers that, oh, well, tomorrow, if your house is on fire, just say, kiss the house goodbye, because the firemen are on strike, rightly, because they are upset about this film. So, you know, that turns people's anger against the artists, against the films, filmmakers, you know.
Were there any fires that you were accused of being personally responsible for? And did you feel responsible for any of it?
No. They didn't go on strike.
Oh, they didn't really go on strike.
They provoked this threat so that the government can say that they have a right to ban the film. So when the government banned the film, the firemen said, all right, so now we know that.
Director Miloš Forman is my guest. Where were you when the Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia?
I was in Paris in that time. I was in Paris working on a script for my first American movie. And that's where I learned about it.
And your family was still in Czechoslovakia?
My family was still there, but my French friends, Claude Berry and Paul Rassam, drove in car which they borrowed from François Truffaut to Prague to bring my wife and my children out, which was such a, you know, ridiculously, absurdly funny story, you know, because they crossed the, when they, everything was fine, but when they crossed the border, the Czech population, when the Russian army, you know, was occupying the country, just to confuse the Russians. So they either turned down or turned around all the street signs, all the signs on the roads, on the crossroads and everything. So they, you know, there was no way so that the Russians are confused and couldn't find anything. And it really took, you know, several weeks before they found some places of their interest. So when Claude Berry and Paul Rassam crossed the border going to Prague, suddenly they found themselves, you know, driving around and around, seeing deja vu places because all the, you know, signs on the roads were wrong. When they realized that they, stopped, tried to stop some people, you know, And finally they stopped the motorcyclist who said, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to Prague, just follow me." And he started to drive. So they are now driving, following this motorcyclist. And in the middle of this wild ride through the countryside, the Pole suddenly had an urge to take a leak, right? So he said to Claude, "Stop, I have to take a leak." "What do you mean to stop? You know, I stop and we'll lose him, we'll never find Prague." "Well, what was this? Well, just open the window, roll around the window, do it out of the window." So he climbed into the back seat of the car. And when he's doing it out of the rear window of the car, suddenly a colony of Russian tanks is coming against, And they, they could take this as a provocation. So Claude, by driving the car, the car just grabbed, Paul and just, pulled him back into the car. And he just sprinkled all over the François Truffaut's new Daimler, car. But then finally they reached Prague and they brought my wife and my children out.
Miloš Forman speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is presenting a 2-week retrospective of his films. It began last night. In the second half of today's show, we'll hear about 2 of those films, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The People vs. Larry Flynt. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. What's it like to make a film about porn after growing up under the restraints of a totalitarian regime? We'll continue our Fresh Air retrospective with director Miloš Forman. Also, David Edelstein reviews director Doug Liman's new thriller, Jumper, and I see what made the cut in the broadcast network version of Dexter, the Showtime serial killer series that moves to CBS this Sunday. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Last night, the Museum of Modern Art in New York kicked off a 2-week retrospective of the films of Miloš Forman. Today on Fresh Air, we're listening to a couple of conversations Terry had with the acclaimed Czech director, whose movies include Amadeus, Hair, The People vs. Larry Flynt, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. When Terry spoke to Milos Forman in 1994, she asked him about Cuckoo's Nest, which was released in 1975. The film won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. Let's hear a clip from the film, which starred Jack Nicholson as the rebellious mental patient McMurphy and Louise Fletcher as his nemesis, the no-nonsense Nurse Ratched. McMurphy has entered the psych ward only to avoid prison, but the constant Muzak is beginning to drive him crazy for real.
Excuse me, miss. Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
That music is for everyone, Mr. McMurphy.
Yeah, I know, but you think we might ease it down a little bit so maybe the boys didn't have to shout, huh?
What you probably don't realize is that we have a lot of old men on this ward who couldn't hear the music if we turned it lower. That music is all they have. Your hand is staining my window.
Sorry, ma'am. Really sorry.
Mr. McMurphy, your medication.
What's in the horse pill?
It's just medicine. It's good for you.
Yeah, but I don't like the idea of taking something if I don't know what it is.
Don't get upset, Mr. McMurphy.
I'm not getting upset, Miss Pilbo. It's just that I don't want anyone to try and slip me saltpeter.
It's all right, Nurse Pilbo. If Mr. McMurphy doesn't want to take his medication orally, I'm sure we can arrange that he can have it some other way. But I don't think you'd like it, Mr. McMurphy.
The second film you made in the United States, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is one of your most famous films that got a bunch of Academy Awards. You keep stressing the absurdity of stories that surrounded life under communism in Czechoslovakia. And you found out that you had been sent a copy of the novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest years before you actually made the movie, but you never got it.
Well, that was Kirk Douglas who bought the rights for the book, you know, when it was even before it was published, and he loved the book and he wanted to make a movie, but never succeeded to get money to do it. But in that times, he was still hoping to do it, and he was in Prague on a goodwill mission, which was originated by President Kennedy, and he came to Prague because he did the adaptation of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for Broadway. Kirk Douglas. And he started it on Broadway. And even there, you know, this adaptation at that time flopped. So suddenly he had time on his hands. So he accepted to go to Eastern Europe and Central Europe. So he went to Prague. They showed him one of my films. He liked it. And he asked me at the party if he can send me a book and if I would read it and tell him, you know. I said, of course, of course, of course. And, you know, the book never came, so I thought, well, that he, well, you know, another American big shot, you know. the moment he left the room, he already forgot. And okay. 10 years later, I'm already here in the United States, and I get a book in an envelope sent by the producers, Saul Zenz and Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas's son, if I would read it. And that was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And, well, you know, I said yes, it was the most fascinating, intelligent piece of literature in the times I was offered and read. And when a few weeks later I met Kirk, he said, you Czechs, you son of a bitches. I said, why are you saying that? Well, listen, I was sending you 10 years ago this book, and you don't have even a courtesy to say, you know, kiss off or something like that. And I told him, well, listen, this is, you know, the same thing I thought about you. Well, what happened was he sent the book, but the censors at the customs confiscated the book as a subversive literature without informing Kirk Douglas that the book, or sending it back to Kirk Douglas, and without informing me.
So did Michael Douglas, when he sent you the book, did he know that his father had sent it to you 10 years before?
That's the funny thing. No, he didn't. It was some kind of a strange fate that the book came back again to me by Kirk's son and soldiers, you know.
Miloš Forman, speaking in 1994 with Terry Gross. Last night, the Museum of Modern Art kicked off a 2-week retrospective of Forman's movies. We'll continue our retrospective after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Today, we're listening back to conversations with film director Miloš Forman. Terry spoke with him a second time in 1996 about his film The People vs. Larry Flynt, starring Woody Harrelson as the publisher of Hustler magazine. The film follows Flynt's rise from small-time strip joint owner to pornography mogul. It also follows Flynt in and out of court as he uses the First Amendment to defend himself against obscenity charges. During one of his obscenity trials, he was shot outside the courthouse, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. In this scene, he's about to board a plane in defiance of a court order not to leave Los Angeles. His lawyer, played by Edward Norton, is fed up with Flynt's courtroom antics and his continued defiance of judges.
Larry! Hey! Larry! Hey! Larry, you're not getting on that plane.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not. Don't do it. Do you think this is some kind of a game we're playing?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's a f***ing joke. 5.5 years since they shot me and the government...
Hey, I was there too, all right? You remember? You don't see me running around pissing off everybody we're trying to get to help us.
Yeah, well, you can walk and you can f***, and I'm in this chair. And I got money, okay? I got money, and that gives me the power to shake up this system, Dougie.
Well, find somebody else to help you then. Because this is not what I signed on for. I don't even know what we're engaged in anymore, Larry. If you get on that plane, I quit.
Alan, don't be so melodramatic. You don't want to quit me. I'm your dream client. I'm the most fun, I'm rich, and I'm always in trouble.
You've said that one of the reasons why you were interested in the movie is because you're interested in freedom of expression, and you lived under two totalitarian regimes growing up in Czechoslovakia, first the Nazis and then the communists. And I'm wondering if some of Larry Flynt's uses of the right to free speech seemed trivial to you, both the pornography and things like nude photographs of Jackie Onassis. Having been deprived of free speech, did this seem like such a trivial way of taking advantage of it?
Yes, there is a lot of trivial things in what Larry Flynt is doing, and there is a lot of, you know, tasteless things in which what he's doing. But, you know, freedom of the speech is much bigger than Larry Flynt himself, you know. This country really never experienced censorship. And so, you know, we are taking the freedom for granted, and we don't know what kind of terrible consequences the loss of freedom of speech can have. Because, it might ruffle some feathers when I say, yes, we have to strive for 100% freedom of the speech. Because once you open the door to censorship, it never stops with pornography. It never stops with smut. It starts to spread. Who is going to decide what is obscene and who is not obscene? What is not obscene?
Was there pornography when you were growing up in Czechoslovakia?
No, there was not pornography. You know, that's the funny thing. You know, it's probably for this, moralists who are calling for censorship, the totalitarian regime would be ideal. Because for 40 years, you wouldn't see any pornography on Czech television or in Czech movies or on the magazines racks. You wouldn't see any, violence, anything like that. Everything was... And the good question is, do you think that any kind of a bad things which we try to blame, our moral relaxation for, that they didn't exist in those times? Oh, my God. They were as rampant as always before and always after, you know.
Now, you have Larry Flint playing a judge in Cincinnati who sentences Larry Flint to 25 years in an obscenity case. Did Larry Flint ask to play that part?
No. I was just joking one day, and I had a kick to say, you know, Larry, do you want to sentence yourself to 25 years in prison? And he laughed and said, oh, why not? So he's there, and we all had it. You know, it brought some kind of a wonderful feeling and atmosphere on the set because, everybody had a kick out of it.
Something I'd read that you said about pornography, you've said that pornography, that you were brought up in an environment where pornography was considered bad, and you've never shaken that attitude about pornography. And you also feel especially uncomfortable if someone sees you while you're looking at pornography. And I'd like you to explain why.
Well, it has something to do with my upbringing, I guess, you know, because I was born in a small town. My parents, my father was a teacher, my mother was a housewife, but very active in socials, you know, circles in the town. And that, I don't know, I was going to church, and all this made me feel like the sex is bad, except in marriage, you know, that it's something I should be ashamed of even to think about, you know. And that just stays with you, it stays with me forever, I guess. You know, when I was, I never bought Hustler. I bought Playboy maybe, once I bought Playboy when the Jimmy Carter's interview was in the Playboy, and I was blushing when I was buying it at the corner of 57th Street and 6th Avenue, and I had a feeling that everybody is looking at me, and everybody is looking at me, you know, with such a disdain, and so I was like running home.
No. You could tell me if this is too personal, okay? You grew up during World War II. Your parents were both killed in concentration camps in Czechoslovakia. So you were on your own by the time you were 8, I think. How did you learn about the facts of life without a family?
Well, I lived with other families afterwards, and listen, how do you learn about these things? It's so ridiculous to think today that, you know, we have to just hide everything from our children and then they will be a wonderful citizens, you know. I remember that for us, when I was already 6 years old, I discovered a medical book, you know, in my father's library. And every time I was home alone, I was browsing, you know, through this book, watching this, you know, drawings of human body without clothes. That's how you discover things. You know, also to believe that films or television, that they are so powerful, that you are educating so beautifully your children for 15, 20 years, and then that poor son of mine sees one movie or one television show and all this, my education goes down the drain. It's ridiculous, you know.
Did The People versus Larry Flint get an R rating?
Yes.
Now, how, as a film director, how do you feel about the rating system?
I think it's good. I think the only censorship should exist in the family. Yes, the parents, they are responsible. They must be responsible fully for the education of their children. If they deem something which is improper for their children until they are adults, you know, yes, they should have a chance. And so the rating system helps them. And I think it works. It works, you know. The danger is that decision what the children or people can see or hear will be done by some government agency or some community board of censors. You know, that's the danger.
Milos Forman, speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. A 2-week retrospective of his film career began last night at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Jumper is the new sci-fi movie by Doug Liman, the director of The Bourne Identity, Go, Swingers, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. It stars Hayden Christensen, best known for his starring role in the last two Star Wars films, as a man who can think about a place and then be there. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Doug Liman's Jumper is so in tune with the vocabulary of modern action movies that you can almost ignore how vacuous it is and go with the quantum flow. It's about a guy named David Rice, who discovers he has the power to teleport himself anywhere, a few feet down the sofa to pick up the TV remote, or half a world away for lunch on top of the Sphinx. There's no scientific explanation for his gift, but I'm not sure gamma rays would make the film more realistic. The point is that thrillers are more hyperkinetic and computer-generated than ever, and no hero lends himself to a stream of fancy jump cuts like a so-called jumper. A fight begins on one continent, continues on another, and ends on a third, around the world in 80 blows. David is played by the expressive Max Thoreau as a youth and Hayden Christensen when he's older and blanker. Deeply alienated, David grows up with a drunk for a dad and no mom, and when he discovers his sudden ability to jump from place to place, he doesn't become a do-gooder. He moves to New York and robs bank vaults. David's refusal to play Superman is made into a cruel joke. He watches on TV as Katrina victims on their rooftops call for help, reaches for his umbrella, then jumps to England to pick up a woman at a bar. It's bracingly unromantic for a mainstream thriller. But something terrifying stands between David and boundless self-gratification, a fanatical sect of jumper hunters called paladins who track and skewer them on the grounds that jumping is an abomination in the eyes of the Lord. The paladins are led by Samuel L. Jackson with white fungus on his head. It's either the worst rug ever, or Jackson is actually a mushroom from outer space.
Anybody can rob a bank. What I'd like to know is how you rob a bank without opening any doors.
This conversation's over.
This conversation's not over. Do you answer my question?
Tell me. How'd you last this long, huh?
That zapping stuff you heard? That's the electrified wand and spider web that keep jumpers from jumping. The paladins also have a machine that can follow a jumper's trail through space. They chase David to Rome, where he's busy showing off for his pretty, dull girlfriend, Millie, played by Rachel Bilson from The O.C. He had a crush on her in high school, and they meet again in a bar, where she dabs at his face after a fight and says, "You're bleeding a little. We should take care of that." Has that line ever not been a prelude to sex? It's too bad Hayden Christensen doesn't bring much to the party. What is it about his voice that's so dead, even without dialogue by George Lucas? He's Canadian, but his accent makes him sound like he's from nowhere, and it wipes out the impact of his eyes, which occasionally flash with real emotion. But the big disconnect at the heart of Jumper is that a guy who doesn't walk anywhere, who can't even bother to slide down his couch for the TV remote, hasn't got an ounce of flab, and even jumps to Fiji to surf the big waves. His muscles should have atrophied years ago. Jumper is really the ultimate couch potato escapist fantasy, aimed at the part of us that dreams of sailing off the couch and merging with the action on screen. It has a lot of buzz, and it's fairly entertaining, but I can imagine the cries of cheat at the open-ended ending, which plays like the fade-out of a TV pilot. If you're a Hollywood executive, you can't just deliver one hit movie anymore. You only get the big bonus for delivering a franchise. But the only way I can see people lining up to see Jumper 2 is if Samuel Jackson's hair sprouts legs and marches on Tokyo.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, I'll look at Dexter, an edgy Showtime cable series relocating to CBS this weekend. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com. The TV writers' strike is over now, but it'll be months before things return to something resembling normal. Meanwhile, as the networks flood their primetime schedules with terrible reality shows and other stopgap measures, CBS is trying something daringly different. It's presenting a scripted series, a really, really good one, that's never been on broadcast TV. It's called Dexter, and chances are you've heard of it. It stars Michael C. Hall, the repressed funeral home director of HBO's Six Feet Under, as another character who's surrounded by death. This time, Hall plays a guy named Dexter Morgan, who works in forensics for the Miami Police Department. He's a blood spatter expert by day, analyzing crime scenes. And in his off hours, he moonlights. He tracks down serial killers who are still at large. And, here's the big creepy twist, he murders them. In other words, he's a serial killer of serial killers. Based on a novel by Jeff Lindsay, the TV version of Dexter retains enough of the character's first-person narration to get us inside Dexter's head, and it's a very strange place to be. Because of the same childhood trauma that left him with a fascination for blood and death, Dexter thinks he has no real emotions. Instead, he fakes casual conversation, avoids intimacy, and collects blood slide samples from his victims as a sort of hobby. Though the chances are good you've heard of Dexter, chances are even better that you've never seen it. The program, which recently ended its second season, is presented on the Showtime cable network. Its average audience there is about 1 million viewers, making it unseen by most of the country. CBS has announced plans to televise the entire first season of Dexter beginning Sunday, all 12 episodes. It's giving Showtime almost 50 minutes of each broadcast hour for program content, about 7 minutes more than most network dramas get. That sounds generous, but considering the program's controversial nature, selling enough ads might be a problem anyway. As for conforming to broadcast standards, there are three issues when a program like this comes from premium cable, where there are no censorial standards, to a more restrictive format. Those issues are sex, violence, and language. Programs try to get around the language by recording alternate versions of potentially troublesome dialogue while the shows are made. Sex and violence has to be edited, sometimes substantially, and the result can be vastly different from the original article. I can't bear to watch either the TBS version of HBO's Sex and the City or the A&E version of The Sopranos because they're so painfully watered down. And even Dexter on CBS has some awkwardly edited dialogue. Usually, it's whenever Dexter is confronted by Doakes, an aggressive and angry sergeant who doesn't like Dexter and doesn't hide his animosity. Here's a scene where Dexter, played by Michael C. Hall, is examining a crime scene photo given to him by Doakes, played by Eric King. The dialogue you're about to hear, the tamer version re-recorded for CBS, is, quite literally, frickin' ridiculous. But it does preserve the relationship between the characters, as well as Dexter's ghoulish voiceover afterward.
What about these? The Hotel Cokehead murders, this dealer and the girl.
Oh. Well, this Hallmark-looking couple didn't die by the hands of a professional. No, this is child's play. Messy work. All that blood on the walls looks like a finger painting.
You give me the freaking creeps. You know that, Dexter.
Is there something I could do?
Yeah, you can give me your freaking analysis on the blood spatter on these killings. You think I'm here to invite you to my nephew's bris?
I didn't know you were Jewish.
Shut the hell up and write your report already.
Don't even know why I need you. Grab a crayon, psycho, and scribble this down. Rival dealer came in, two scumbags slashed to hell, dealer stole the drugs. Wham, bam, done. And I don't give a damn what you say, because that's what happened, and that's who I'm looking for.
Sure. I guess. But I should get over there.
Then get over there already, you freaking weirdo. I need it quick.
I'm on it, Sergeant.
The only real question I have is why, in a building full of cops, all supposedly with a keen insight into the human soul, is Doakes the only one who gets the creeps from me?
Other cuts in Dexter are less obvious, and, surprisingly, not that many are necessary. The first season of Dexter has virtually no sex and only a scene or two involving nudity. The violence, given the subject, is much more suggested than overt. Purists will note and miss the image of Dexter running a sharp scalpel lightly across an imminent victim's cheek to draw the first hint of blood. On CBS, we see the before and after, but not the during. And that's kind of cowardly. Like Tony Soprano, Dexter Morgan can be a monster. And if you don't get to witness that and feel squeamish about it, you miss the point of the whole series. I wonder how CBS will handle the episode near the end of the season, when one crime scene contains almost as much blood as that elevator in The Shining. I worry more, though, whether CBS will let the series run that long. The network has a history of canceling serialized dramas long before their central mysteries are solved. And make no mistake, the first year of Dexter is a season-long mystery. But it's a great one. Dexter ended up on my top 10 list for the year in 2007. I'd prefer people watch the original version, which is out on DVD. But watching on CBS is a lot cheaper, and it's a mammoth promotional opportunity for the original series on Showtime, which is still running. If CBS can't make dramas this good anymore, at least for now, they know where to find them. You can download podcasts of our show at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Minhivar directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hirsfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Paris Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Necessary Sins, a memoir by Lynn Darling about marriage, loss, and the many lessons of love. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to help protect the world's whales at pewtrusts.org. And from the NASDAQ Educational Foundation, dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship around the world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That banana you ate this morning, it's not the same one your grandparents ate. And because of a banana epidemic, it might not be the same one your grandchildren eat either. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dan Coppell about his new book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Join us for the next Fresh Air.